Hello and welcome to the Deathcast, early bird ad and bullshit free version, where this week we are taking our seventh and final look at the Texas killing fields. As always, I have the normal shoutouts to Channel and Anthony, the first two Patreon members, as well as to Debbie, Samantha, Betty, and Matt for being the largest Patreon contributors monthly. You guys are all awesome. All right, now that all that's out of the way, get yourself a drink, find a nice comfy chair, close your eyes, kick back, and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, we had been talking about the murders committed by William Lewis Reese, who's a 66-year-old pipe fitter that was eventually convicted for the murders of Laura Smither, Kelly Cox, Tiffany Johnson in Oklahoma, and Jessica Kane. Now, according to various lists, there are still a few other murders that are lumped in with the Texas killing field murders. Most of these do not fit the MO of earlier crimes that had taken place, and based on that, it's highly unlikely that any of the individuals who have been convicted for these crimes are responsible for any of these, nor do I think that any of the suspects that we're going to be discussing in this episode were involved in these killings. However, for the sake of completeness, and in the hopes that maybe somebody knows something, saw something, heard something, we are going to briefly cover these last few cases. The first victim was a 57-year-old Vietnamese woman by the name of Tat Tran Harriman. Now, according to her children, Miss Harriman had decided to visit relatives in Texas as she was planning on moving there after her companion had died a few years ago. From all indications, Miss Harriman had a very close-knit family. She had fled Vietnam after a failed marriage, bringing with her her oldest son. We know had gone over her car before she left. She had been planning on driving from Corpus Christi to League City, Texas, along I-35. And we know that she left around 5 a.m. on July 12th, 2001, from her oldest son's home in League City. She was driving a 1995 Lincoln Continental. Tat Harriman, as she is known, is described as being 4 feet 11 inches tall and weighing around 100 pounds. Her maroon Lincoln Continental bore a personalized license plate reading TOTSI. It's known that numerous people reported seeing Harriman's car driving around the Houston area, and that one individual gave police a description of a man she said was driving the car. Her mobile phone is believed to have been turned off, and there has been no activity from it. Unfortunately, it's highly doubtful that Tat Harriman is, at this point, still alive, but her family is still hoping that people will maybe remember this and be able to help find out what happened to their mother. You can contact the League City Police Department if you have any information about this case at 281-332-2566. On July 12, 2002, a 23-year-old blonde woman named Sarah Ann Lewis Trusty was seen riding her bicycle in Algoa, Texas, near a church that she frequented. This was around 11 p.m. that evening. Now, according to the police in Texas City, the day prior to Sarah disappearing, she and her husband had gotten into an argument, and as he would later tell police, Sarah left their domicile. No one has reported seeing her since then that we are aware of. However, and with Sarah's disappearance, we actually have some audio from one of the detectives that is working her case. And we're going to listen to that at this point to get a better idea of what happened with Sarah.
It's the murder of Sarah Powers, hyphen trustee. Her legal name is Sarah Powers. And we have trustee in some of the documents because she was allegedly married to a gentleman by the name of William Trustee. I've never seen any documentation they were legally married, but that's why she has two last names.
Okay.
This is a case from 2002, so it's been a while, like almost 23 years this mm-hmm. July. So on July 13th, 2002, at about 1 p.m., Mr. William Trustee reported his wife missing to the Galveston County Sheriff's Department. They lived out in what was referred to as Algoa, Texas, which is up Highway 6 area, the Santa Fe area. And they lived in the 300 block of Avenue E on a street there in a trailer. Mr. Trustee tells the sheriff's deputy that took the report that day, that afternoon, that the evening before, between 8:30 and 9:30 approximately that evening, he and Sarah got into an argument over either dinner or eating with family members. He reported that Sarah walked away from the residence. A short time later, he got in his truck and then found her walking down the road, kind of like towards the Highway 6 area. They live off of Highway 6. Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly how far. It's not that. It's within walking distance.
Mm-hmm. Now, according to this William Trustee, he spoke to Sarah, tried to get her to come back home. She refused. So at this point, he drives back to the house. So the following day, the 14th, Sarah's family finds her bike over at the church that she worked at part-time as a cleaning lady. So we have a bit of a mystery here, is according to her husband or boyfriend, whatever he was, William Trustee, Sarah had walked away from the house. So now there's speculation as to how the bike got over to the church. On July 28th of 2002, at roughly 6:30 in the morning, a fisherman is out near a dike in Texas City over by a reservoir when they encounter a female body lying on the rocks next to the water's edge. These police respond. They report that she's wearing white shirt, white shorts, some jewelry, as well as a light blue plastic necklace. Some reports list this as being almost like a seashell necklace. It was also a matching anklet to this necklace found on the body. Now, I could not find anything listing her cause of death. We do know there was a pretty big search effort undertaken to try and find clues, and that Tim Miller, whose 16-year-old daughter Laura Lynn Miller was murdered in League City in 1986, he has a group called EquiSearch, or Texas EquiSearch, that helps parents of missing children across the country. They, in fact, got involved in this. There's not a lot of evidence. We know that her former partner is considered a possible suspect. There was also a neighbor by the name of Floyd Johnson, who apparently ended up moving the day after Sarah went missing, who, according to the police, again, had an alibi. I want to stress, however, that there is no evidence connecting either of these two men to Sarah's disappearance. Also, according to police, Sarah liked to quote-unquote party. This area where her body was found was known to have quite a number of piers and shrimp boats on it, and according to family members who told this to police, Sarah was believed to have gone out there quite often at night to party with these people working on the shrimp boats. Whether or not this is true, I cannot say with absolute certainty. However, this is the information that we are getting from the police. Now, the interview that I played you a portion of was given roughly 6 weeks ago. So if anyone has any information concerning Sarah's disappearance and subsequent murder, you can contact League City Detectives. The phone number will be in the description to this episode. Now, the last victim that we're going to look at in this series is a 16-year-old by the name of Teresa Lynn Vanegas. There's not a lot of information out there concerning Teresa. We know that she was last seen early on the evening of October 31st of 2006, walking near the Green K subdivision in Dixon City. Her body was found with her hair cut. She had been raped and strangled to death either on November 2nd or November 3rd of 2006, across from Dixon City High School in a field. Now, police have said that this is still an active case, which is more likely than not why we don't have any information on Teresa. They have said that there have been a number of suspects that they've talked to over the course of the investigation. However, none of these leads has panned out as of yet to lead to an arrest for Teresa's murderer. Now, as you can see, all of these cases are greatly different from the cases that we covered prior in this series concerning the Texas killing fields. None of them involve the I-45 corridor, but in the hopes that somebody is going to hear this and may remember something or know somebody who knows something, I have to include them in this episode. We're now going to turn our attention at some suspects that have cropped up over the years in relation to some of these crimes. Now, these are individuals who are either behind bars for other crimes or who police put their names out there in the hopes that someone knows something. And I want to be very clear that none of these individuals have been charged for any of these murders or been convicted of any of them. Now, the first suspect actually came via their own actions. At some point in the 90s, this individual wrote two letters from a Texas prison, one to the Harris County District Attorney and the other to the District Attorney in Galveston County. Now, when police initially went to speak with this individual, he refused to talk, despite the fact that in these letters he had confessed to the murders. Specifically, I'm talking about the 11 murders that took place during the 1970s. This individual named Edward Harold Bell contacted both of these district attorneys claiming responsibility for the crimes, specifically the murders of Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson, claiming that he had shot both girls with a .357 Magnum handgun. He stated that he had shot Debbie in the neck or the head and Maria in the neck or the back. That when he killed the girls, he was standing above them on a small bridge, and that their hands and feet were tied in front of them with nylon rope. The man stated in these letters that this was proof that he had committed these crimes. However, that if he were ever brought into a courtroom to be tried for these murders, he would plead not guilty. As in his letters, Bell claimed he had been brainwashed into committing these murders. Now, here's the problem. When police received these letters in 1999 and went to talk to him, Bell wouldn't speak with officers. There was a general belief that he might have been blowing smoke up their ass, as Bell was claiming that he was in a program that had brainwashed him to commit these crimes, but also because he gave no specifics. That is, hold back information that only the killer would know about these murders. So police set out to talk with Bell yet again in 2006 to see if they could get this self-confessed serial killer to reveal details that only the real killer would know. It is important to note that the main reason police took Bell's confession as possibly being true is that it was known that during the 1970s, he lived in Galveston and was part owner of a dive shop located on S Road. Now, the main officer that was investigating these crimes in 2006 believed that Bell was responsible for the crimes. He later told journalists that some of the information that Bell had given in these letters to the district attorney could only have been known by somebody that had committed these crimes, specifically the fact that victims' hands were tied in front of them, that Johnson's body was found closer to the bridge, while her friend Debbie Ackerman was found further out in the water, and that they both had wounds to the neck slash head region. It's important to point out, however, that in police records, it's stated that, at least with Debbie Ackerman, she had been tied up with black string, not the quote-unquote white nylon string that Bell had described in his letters. So we're going to look into Edward Bell at this point to see if we can ascertain anything that might point to him as being the actual perpetrator of these crimes. Then we're going to look at the statements that Bell eventually gives to the police concerning these murders. Edward Harold Bell was born on May 26, 1939. In Houston, Texas, his father was Carl Clayton Bell, who worked as an oil field worker. We don't really have his mother's name, at least from anything I could discover, but we know that their parents remained married, that Bell had an older brother named Larry, that the family moved around fairly often following Clayton's work in the oil fields. According to numerous reports, by the time that Edward, known by the nickname Butch to most, was in junior high school, the family had settled in New Ulm, which is a town that's about an hour west of Houston, outside of Columbus, Texas. People who knew Bell during his youth said that he was very intelligent, well-liked, and a good overall kid. It's known that he was an Eagle Scout. And basically, he and his brother grew up on a farm raising livestock. Now, in later life, Bell would say that he was abused by both his father as well as various scoutmasters. And he would go on to make further disturbing claims, such as claims that his father told him to commit violence acts like robbery, rape, and murder, and encouraged Edward to kill himself. Now, there's a story out there that I can neither confirm nor deny that states that Edward Bell and the rest of his family witnessed his cousin killing their own father. I would have to assume that this is an uncle. As the story goes, at least according to Edward Bell, the uncle was torturing his wife, pouring water down her throat, and her son shot the man in an effort to make him stop. And again, these are stories that I can neither confirm nor deny having taken place. We know that he graduated high school in 1957 and enrolled at Texas A&M. While he had excelled in high school, in college, Bell seemed to struggle a bit. And supposedly, it's while he's in college that Edward Bell picks up his enthusiasm for scuba diving. We do know that he meets his wife, Bonnie, while he's attending Texas A&M, and that Bonnie had attended Baylor University, eventually marrying while Ed was still going to college. Basically, everyone who knew Edward Bell said that there were no indications anywhere at any time that he was capable of murder, rape, or any of the other crimes that he would later be convicted of or that he would implicate himself in. However, there were some signs that all was not right inside Edward Bell's mind. At some point in 1966, Edward Bell was arrested after exposing himself to a pair of girls in Sudan, which is a small farming community in Lamb County, Texas, for which he is sentenced to an indeterminate period in a psychiatric hospital for treatment. We know that he's eventually released, at which point he continues on with his studies. Now, by 1969, Bell is at Texas Tech University, where he is working towards his master's degree in physical education. And on April 3rd of 1969, Bell is arrested inside of a physical education building at the Texas Tech campus after he exposes himself to a 13-year-old girl. Now, this young girl ends up being the daughter of a Lubbock police officer, and according to the girl, she was outside of her home when a man who matched Bell's description stepped from a car wearing only a t-shirt. He ends up being held on bond, and eventually works out a deal where he is sent to the University of Texas Medical Branch. During this period of time, it's said that Bell repeatedly made unnatural sexual advances towards underage female patients. Now, right around this point in time, Bell ends up getting a divorce from Bonnie. He's kicked out of Texas Tech and confined in this psych ward for 9 months or until a physician deems Bell suitably treated. In files from this particular incarceration, it's noted that Edward Bell seemed to be too eager to help and refused to take responsibility for his actions, describing the quote-unquote perversions he had done as stemming from both stress at work as well as at home. Despite the fact that Bell was said to be making sexual advances towards underage girls, 3 months after his inpatient admission, he is released on overnight passes and will eventually be discharged completely in July of 1970. Now, this next point is rather contentious. Some reports have it that while he's undergoing treatment at this hospital. Ed marries a 17-year-old girl who is also a patient. Other reports state that the girl was in fact 20 years old. In any case, Ed Bell marries for the second time to a woman by the name of Debbie. After his discharge, he and his new bride move down to the Galveston area, where they rent an apartment, and Ed meets an individual by the name of Doug Prunes, who owns a scuba diving company. Edward Bell eventually becomes partners with Doug. Decades later, police are going to learn that this surfshop was one of at least two that many of the victims, including Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson, frequented during the summer of 1971. This is important to investigators as it places a number of these victims into Edward Bell's sphere. Police also learn that the apartment that Bell lived in was in walking distance of both the scuba shop as well as the Wicks Ski School, which, if you'll recall, was a hangout of a number of the victims during that summer of 1971, specifically Sharon Shaw and Rhonda Johnson, both frequented the Wicks Ski School and were last seen there on the day that they disappeared in August. We know that Edward Bell made the majority of his money selling real estate near the Big Bend National Park, that he had an office in Houston, and also invested heavily in tugboats. One piece of information that particularly caught detectives' interest was the fact that some of the victims were last seen getting into a white van. In 1972, Bell is going to end up being arrested in Louisiana after exposing himself to a girl, and the arresting officer notes in his report that Bell was driving a 1971 white Ford van. They also learned that in the weeks leading up to Renee Johnson and Sharon Shaw's disappearances, they had been seen hanging out with two older men that were described as being in their 20s or 30s, and that their friends found the entire situation creepy. If you'll recall from our coverage on that particular set of disappearances and murders, the girls were talking about running away to California with these individuals, and it later emerged that one of these men was said to have driven a van. Police also uncovered evidence by witness statements that placed Debbie Ackerman and Renee Johnson at the apartment complex that Edward Bell lived at. Some witnesses told police that Bell and his wife lived for a period of time in a red camper, and that at some point during the summer of 1971, Bell moved this camper to Humble Camp Road. The reason that this was important to investigators is that Humble Camp Road led to the Turner Bayou Bridge, which is where Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson's bodies were later discovered. Police also noted the fact that Edward Bell was released in July of 1970, and that the murders and disappearances began the following summer. Police also connected the fact that Edward Bell had played in marching bands in both high school and college with the fact that Colette Wilson and Brenda Jones both played instruments, and speculated that he may have followed Colette Wilson's band instructor home on the day that she disappeared and had encountered Brenda while she was walking from the hospital. Then the police uncovered information that, for them, placed Edward Bell as a major suspect in the spate of disappearances. In June of 1971, a teenager was sunbathing in her backyard and looked up to find a man she did not know watching her and masturbating vigorously. She later identified this man as Edward Bell. Now, these arrests for indecent exposure are going to continue to plague Edward Bell, with charges either being dropped in many of the cases or simple fines being paid. Police were also able to discover that Bell had connections to other victims, such as Gloria Gonzalez, who is known to have lived in a neighborhood that Edward Bell had business connections in. But he also had ties to some of the crime scenes, particularly the Attucks Reservoir, where both Colette Wilson and Gloria Gonzalez's bodies would later be discovered. We know that in 1974, Bell is arrested after exposing himself to two girls that he happened upon while driving, and that shortly after this, a former patient at the psychiatric hospital Bell had most recently been in accused him of rape, although she later dropped the charges. The last double homicide tied to the Texas killing fields in the 1970, that of Brooks Bracewell and Georgia Greer, was linked to Bell through the fact that he owned property in the area where the girls' bodies were discovered. And the last girl, 12-year-old Susan Bowers, who disappeared near her grandparents' home in Galveston in 1977, was linked to Bell due to the fact that one of the tugboat captains whose boat Bell had invested in lived directly behind the grandparents' home. And according to this captain, Bell was at the house continuously. Then things take a dramatic turn in the life of Edward Bell. On August 24th, 1978, Bell, who by this point was driving a red and white GMC pickup truck, pulled up in front of a house in Pasadena, Texas. Now, Pasadena is southeast of Houston. In front of this house, there was a group of children playing, and according to reports, Bell stepped from the truck wearing nothing but a t-shirt and began masturbating in front of the children, who began to scream. A nearby man, a 26-year-old veteran who had recently returned from a tour of active duty named Larry Dickens, was nearby, heard the girls screaming, heard his mother on the phone with the police, ran towards Bell's truck and grabbed the keys from the ignition. In retaliation for this, Edward Bell grabs a .22 pistol from the pickup truck and shoots Larry four times. This leads Larry's mother to contact the police yet again. Now, Larry attempts to flee and ends up collapsing in his mother's driveway, at which point Bell, now in possession of a high-powered rifle that he had in the back of the truck, walks up to Larry, straddles him, and shoots him fatally just as Larry's sister arrives, at which point Bell attempts to flee the scene. Somehow in all of this, Bell had gotten the keys for his truck back. The police give chase and, at least according to some records, a gun battle ensues, which ends up with Edward Bell in the back of a police car. He is driven back to the Dickens home, where he is identified as the man seen both masturbating and with committing murder. He's able to post bond while he awaits trial. Not long after this, Bell readmits himself to the psychiatric ward in Galveston. Bell is given a drug which is said to be used for chemical castration while he's in this time. From the outside, it appears that Edward Bell was trying to get a hold of his demons, something that he was doing much too much of out in public to begin with. Reality, Bell was simply biding his time. He was selling off all of his assets with the exception of one boat. And by the time his next court appearance came around, it was discovered that Edward Bell, with roughly $140,000 in his pocket, had fled the area in his boat. Now, Edward Bell is going to end up on the run for 14 years, although there'll be numerous sightings of him during this 14 years throughout the state of Texas. The most well-known of these sightings places an individual matching Bell's description inside of a young woman's home near the Texas A&M University campus. According to this woman's statement, she saw the reflection of a man coming up behind her with a large hunting knife. She screamed, was able to escape, grabbed a gun, and chased the individual from her home. Whether this is true or not, we have no way of knowing. We do know that Bell spent the majority of his time down in Panama and Mexico, making his living via tours that he would give and instructing people on scuba diving. We also know that he panned for gold and eventually settles into Panama City, where he marries a young girl and works in the port town of Cristobal. In 1985, Edward Bell is listed as Texas's most wanted fugitive. December 2nd of 1982, America's Most Wanted airs an episode that features the murder of Larry Dickens, and the police are flooded with tips, which eventually lead them to Panama, where Bell is discovered living under an alias. Bell is arrested, he fights extradition, but is eventually returned to the United States, where in June of 1993, he finally goes on trial. Amazingly, Bell takes the stand in his own defense and attempts to describe and disparage Mr. Dickens as a religious fanatic who simply attacked him for no reason. Bell further claimed that he had shot Dickens in self-defense before correcting himself and saying the gun had gone off accidentally when he was tripped by Larry Dickens. According to members of Larry's family, during the trial, Larry Bell, Ed's older brother, approached them and tearfully apologized to the family for what Edward had done, letting them know that he had not always been like this, and that something had gone seriously wrong in his brother's mind somewhere along the way. Bell ends up being convicted for the murder and given a 70-year prison sentence, which he officially begins serving in July of 1993. It's important to note that eventually Bell is going to talk with a journalist and claim that he killed 11 young women in and around Galveston, starting in 1971 and eventually ending in 1977. However, the names that he gave did not match all of the victims known to be linked to the Texas killing fields, and these other victim names that he gave are of people unknown to authorities. During one interview, Bell called the victims the 11 who went to heaven. Pressed as to why Bell had not been prosecuted, authorities in Texas stated that at that point in time, a confession alone was not enough to bring a conviction against anyone, nor could a charges be brought on a confession alone. It's important to note here that Edward Bell is eventually going to recant his various confessions, but not before claiming that he was part of a program that had brainwashed him into both exposing himself to young girls and committing the murders. The entire thing is just a mix of delusions that, if we are to believe the fact that Edward Bell committed these 11 murders, he concocted an effort to get out of responsibility for these crimes is when Bell was talking to authorities, he stated that he would give a full confession provided he was not held legally responsible for any of the crimes. Now, some believe Edward Bell was in fact responsible for these murders. The authorities in Panama believe he is a suspect in a further 4 rape murders committed in that country during Bell's time there. Others, family members of some of the victims, simply believe that Bell is lying through his teeth in order to get his name in print and to seem important. In any event, Edward Bell ends up dying on April 20th of 2019 at the age of 79. We have one more suspect that we are going to be taking a look at this point. Now, before I get into the specifics of it, I want to clarify something. A lot of sources state that the police put this individual forth as a suspect on the Netflix documentary that came out for the first time. However, the reality is this man was known to police as well as to Tim Miller for decades prior to the release of that documentary, and was actually known to the public for those who knew where to look. The first documented information I could find linking this individual to any of the crimes was actually published in the early 2000s in Texas Monthly Magazine, and this was further expanded upon in the book Deliver Us by Catherine Casey, which came out somewhere in the mid-2010s. This individual that I am speaking of is a former neighbor of the Miller family by the name of Clyde Edwin Hedrick. So who is Clyde Edwin Hedrick? Hedrick was the first individual that Tim Miller, Laura Miller's father, ever brought to the attention of the police. Hedrick was an ex-convict. He had been arrested in Florida and sentenced to 5 years in 1977. Doesn't appear that he had a lot of brushes with the law after that. However, we know that by 1984, he was working as a construction worker living just down the street from the Miller family in Dickinson. Being an ex-felon living nearby a missing girl does not automatically make you a suspect in the eyes of the law, or necessarily even in the eyes of family members. However, what came to light was the fact that Hedrick was the last person seen with a woman by the name of Ellen Ray Beeson. Beeson had been at a bar called the Texas Moon Club on the night that she disappeared. Her body was found over a year later on a dirt road in Galveston County. Her cause of death was later listed as undetermined. At the time of her disappearance and murder, Beeson was 29 years old. Now, according to Hedrick, he was questioned by the police and told authorities that the two of them had gone swimming in a pond near the side of the road. He said that Beeson had drowned and he'd been planning to drive her to the hospital. However, fearing that he might be considered a suspect in her death, he left her body behind. He's going to end up having numerous run-ins with the law after this. Some include attempts to entice a minor, abuse, sexual assault, aggravated kidnapping, criminal trespassing, terroristic threats, possession of marijuana, driving while intoxicated, along with numerous other offenses. Eventually, he's going to be brought to trial for abuse of a corpse and sentenced to a year in jail. And this is because there's not enough evidence to try him for Beeson's murder. However, that is going to change in 2014 when the state of Texas lists her death as a homicide. He's going to end up doing 20 years for involuntary manslaughter. Now, according to Tim Miller, his daughter stated on numerous occasions that she found Heydrich to be frightening. Now, Heydrich took the extraordinary step of defending himself publicly, saying that he did not kill Laura or any of the other young women who went missing. However, there is evidence that links him to another victim besides Laura Miller, and that is Heidi Fye. Heidi Fye was also known to have patronized the Texas Moon Club. Heydrich was said to be a regular, and many believe that Heidi and Heydrich may have crossed paths at the bar. According to Tim Miller, he continuously searched the Calder Field Road dump site and found numerous roofing shingles at the site. Because of the fact that Heydrich worked as a roofer during this period of time, Tim Miller became convinced that Heydrich had in fact murdered his daughter and was using the field not only as a dumping ground for bodies, but also for roofing tiles and other garbage from work sites. At some point during his investigation, Miller learned from Laura's friends that his daughter had in fact been inside Heydrich's home. The instance of this occurred when her friends had gone to Heydrich's house to buy pot, and Laura had gone with them. Miller later said that the police were not interested in his theory or any of the information that he had discovered. Now we're going to break down exactly what occurred with the disappearance of Ellen Beeson. I'm going to get into specifics, okay? After Ellen disappeared, a friend of hers was really worried. She saw her friend's car outside the bar the following day, contacted the family, learned that Ellen had not returned home. After asking around, she heard that Ellen had been seen with Heydrich. She speaks to Heydrich, and Heydrich brushes her off, saying that the two of them had left the bar together, intending to go find this friend whose name is Candy. However, when they were unable to do so, they returned to the bar, and he dropped Ellen off. The last he had seen of her was Ellen getting into a truck with an unknown male driver. However, nothing could be discovered of this driver, and Candy ends up feeling that something untoward has happened to her friend. A few weeks or months after this, Candy encounters Heydrich at this bar, demands again to know where Ellen is, to which Heydrich is supposed to have said, quote, "You want to see where Ellen is? I'll take you to her." At which point, he begins driving towards a causeway before turning off this causeway onto a dirt road and into a field. He brings Candy out into the field, where a couch with tires stacked on top of it is sitting. Removing the tires from on top of the couch, he throws the couch back to reveal to Candy the decomposing body of her friend. He then begins to recount a story that is absolutely unbelievable. According to Heydrich, the two of them had left the bar. Ellen had decided she wanted to go swimming in a local swimming hole, had convinced Heydrich to drive them, and as he sat in the truck drinking a beer and smoking pot, Ellen had attempted to convince him to join her in the water, and he refused. She strips naked and jumps into the water, and after a short period of time, Heydrich grows concerned, turns the lights on of the truck, which illuminate the water, revealing that Ellen is floating face down, apparently the victim of drowning. Heydrich, according to Candy, said that he panicked and dragged her out of the water, redressing her, and considered what to do. After realizing that with his prior conviction of for felony attempted arson, he realized that nobody would believe his story, so he puts Ellen inside of the truck and drives around, eventually deciding to dump her body in a field, which he does before placing the couch and tires on top of it. Afterwards, he is supposed to have said to Candy that if she tells anyone what he has shown her, it will not go good for her. Candy takes this as a threat and remains silent for somewhere around 9 months before an incident occurs that leads her to going to police. In July of 1985, Heydrich supposedly trashes Candy's apartment, and she is so upset by this, she goes to the police and tells them what Heydrich has told her. Heydrich recounts his story of Ellen's supposed death to the police, and they go and find her body. Now, eventually, Heydrich is charged with abuse of a corpse, although no charges can be officially brought against him beyond that. Fast forward to 2010, Tim Miller has never given up his belief that Heydrich is responsible for his daughter's murder. He starts talking to a group of retired law enforcement officers that include a FBI agent who are looking into the Texas Killing Field murders. He brings up Heydrich to these officers, and they start looking into him, and Ellen's body ends up being exhumed for the second time, the first having been in 1993, when a large fracture was found on Ellen's skull that was determined by one medical examiner to have occurred at or around the time of her death. However, the Galveston medical examiner disagreed with this, which is why Clyde Heydrich was only charged with abuse of a corpse. Fast forward to 2012, they again exhume the body, looking at it. The original medical examiner who had done the autopsy on Ellen Beeson has retired, and they are looking at this fracture again. On April 4th of 2013, Clyde Heydrich was arrested for the murder of Susan Ray Beeson. While Heydrich is awaiting trial, a inmate contacts the Alveston County District Attorney's Office and tells them that Heydrich has confessed to the murder of Laura Miller. As the story goes, while reading a newspaper article about Equisearch and Tim Miller, Heydrich said that he'd had sex with and then murdered Laura, along with admitting to killing Heidi Fay and clubbing Ellen Beeson to death with a table leg. In turn, results in further charges being brought against Clyde Heydrich. Obviously, when news of this comes out, it's all over the news in the Houston-Galveston area. Clyde Heydrich insists that he is innocent of all of the things that he is being accused of, stating that he never gave a confession. Eventually, Heydrich is going to be convicted of involuntary manslaughter, sentenced to 20 years. Tim Miller sat and waited for a few months frustrated that there was no new developments in his daughter's murder. On August 25th of 2014, he files a wrongful death lawsuit against Clyde Hedrick. In a quote, Miller stated, "I feel like I'm the father to all four of the girls whose bodies were found out in that field, and I want Clyde Hedrick to tell the truth about what happened to them. That's all I want, the truth. And I want him to tell us who Jane Doe is. I want him to be able to tell her family what happened to her." After Gary Edwin Heidrich is released from prison in 2001, Tim Miller wins a $24 million liability lawsuit against him. However, to the best of our knowledge, he has gained no new evidence about his daughter's murder or that of the other three victims whom it is believed that Heidrich may have murdered. And the last thing we are going to discuss very briefly is a man by the name of Mark Roland Stallings. In 2013, Stallings, who was a convicted kidnapper serving a life sentence, confessed to killing a woman in 1991 who was later identified as Donna Prudhomme, and dumping her body in the Caldor Field Road dump site, as well as another victim. However, it should be noted that as of the recording of this episode, Stallings has not been convicted of any of these murders, although police do think he is the main suspect in Prudhomme's murder. And it is believed that he is most likely responsible for other murders as well. However, other than his admissions, there is no evidence that I am aware of which directly links Stallings to any of these crimes. There you have it, the Texas Killing Fields murders, as stated in earlier episodes. It's my belief that a number of different serial killers were responsible for different clusters of disappearances as murders, but also that some of the crimes were the work of individuals who may or may not have killed again, as some of these crimes that are lumped into this group do not fit the MO of the others that occurred around the time of specific killings. I hope that you guys have enjoyed my coverage of these cases. Until next time, my D&Ders, stay morbid!